I'm Joanne Bennett. I am chairperson of the PHN Section Research Committee, which has put together this session. Starting last year, the research committee has actually sponsored a session at each meeting, and the priority has been community-based participatory research, which for those of you who were here last year, we had a panel of folks who were actually doing community-based participatory public health, population-focused nursing research. And one of the outcomes of last year's discussion was to follow up and address the ethical challenges and managing those challenges and addressing the ethical concerns that come up with community-based participatory research that are somewhat unique to the community-based and participatory approach. So we put together today's panel. Our first speaker is Ruth Malone, a professor from the University of California at San Francisco. And I'll let you start. And we will have 15 minutes at the end of the session we've left for to be able to interact with the panel members. So, and we are passing around a list of people for anyone who would like to be on the research committee and help with planning future sessions and so forth.
Does this one work?
I don't
know. Does this one work?
No.
Maybe. If I push it again?
Okay, that must be something.
I'm going to sort of walk around with this because I feel sort of trapped behind the screen. And hopefully,
do you want me to press?
Cause problems. No, I can press.
Okay, great.
Thank you. So I'm very pleased to be here, and I'm presenting our experience with doing community-based participatory research in a community in San Francisco and the ethical challenges that we encountered with our IRB. I wrote a paper about this, which was our attempt to turn our lemons into lemonade, and that was published in American Journal of Health sometime back. So some of you may have actually seen this presentation before. I think my colleague, Dr. Jurger, has presented it, but that was in the alcohol, tobacco, and other groups program before. So so I do want to acknowledge my co-authors and co-sufferers through our experience and our funders. And I'm supposed to do my presenter disclosure, which is that I own a share of Altria Philip Morris USA, and Reynolds American Tobacco Company stock for research and advocacy purposes. And if anybody is interested in hearing more about that, please talk to me at the end of the meeting. We have a group of nurses that go to do shareholder activism at the shareholder meetings of these companies, because my focus is really broadly on the tobacco industry. So community-based participatory research, as it sounds like, is fairly well known by this group, is looking at addressing health disparities in several ways, by engaging affected communities, by building capacity within those communities, and by establishing partnerships that are based on equity and parity between communities and their academic partners. And between not only residents of the communities, but organizations in the communities and the academic partners or the researchers in whatever capacity, academic or not. Basic principles, and this is one of the reasons I think nurses are particularly well suited to do this kind of research, because we really get this, is that it's about emphasizing strengths, not just needs. It's about actually helping people realize the power that they already have, as opposed to giving it to them in some way. And it's about making changes in the policy or the environmental arena, as opposed to individual behavior change. and disseminating the knowledge from that to all partners in the arrangement. So I'm going to be talking about the FAP project, which is Protecting the Hood Against Tobacco. And this is a project we did in San Francisco in the Bayview Hunters Point community. The Bayview Hunters Point community is a low SES neighborhood. It has a high level of minority population, particularly African Americans. And of course, as you all know, African Americans are disproportionately affected by tobacco-related diseases, and this is an area that we determined that we really wanted to try to address in some way with our partners. The other thing about this particular neighborhood was that in earlier work done by another researcher, 55% of the African Americans, compared to 15% of whites, felt that addressing health was really outside their control. So our hope was to make them realize that this was something that could be addressed from within the community. We really went about this in the way you're supposed to do it. We brought in research partners that we recruited through an earlier focus group study from the community, and we had asked people if they would be interested in working with us on research in the community. And they participated in all phases of the research, including designing the study and thinking about what would be studied, all that, all the things you're supposed to do right. They identified community leaders and groups. They went did outreach to the community. They conducted a community survey to identify obstacles to smoking cessation, because they thought that that was a place to start in terms of thinking about tobacco's effect on the community. Well, one of the things that came up in this survey was that single cigarettes, or loosies as they're known in the community, were sold at many of the convenience and liquor stores that, and of course there were many of those as well, that were in the community. And this was an obstacle to cessation for a number of reasons. Because they were cheap, you know, you could just buy one. They weren't cheap on a per pack basis. I mean, they were a real ripoff for people on a per pack basis. But if you just were scraping together money, you could always go buy one cigarette. They were readily available, and they, of course, didn't have any warnings on them because they were just loose there. And interestingly, our partners, our research partners, this phenomenon was so ubiquitous in the community that our partners didn't even know it was illegal. And I'm not sure if it's illegal in all states, but in California, it is illegal to sell single cigarettes, partially because they don't have a warning on the pack, partially because it has been shown that their availability does tend to decrease people's determination to succeed in quitting smoking. So the community partners decided that they wanted to take a look at this issue and do a prevalence study of single cigarette sales. And they went out and mapped all the convenience and liquor stores in the community. They decided what the boundaries of the community were, and they went and did an assessment so that we had a census of all those stores. And we, of course, the academic partners, went to the IRB and got approval. And we got approval to do an observational study. We just sort of, and this was a place where we kind of screwed up, because we just kind of said, okay, let's go do this. We'll have them take a, you know, they'll look at advertising density, and we had talked about this. We'll look at advertising density in these stores, smoking activity around the stores, because there were people standing out on the sidewalk and so forth, and their store sales practice, including single cigarette sales. This was just going to be through observation on a visit to the store. But our partners came back after we got this approval and said, wait a minute, we can't do just an observational study. We have to actually try to buy a cigarette at each store, which we hadn't kind of thought they were going to do initially. But we agreed when we had discussion, because they said, you can't just hang around in these stores. This is the kind of places that they are. You can't just hang out there. They don't like you to loiter in the first place. and it's dangerous to just hang out. Who knows what else is going on these street corners? This is one of our community research partners standing in front of the no loitering sign. So we can't just hang out here. We need to try to buy a cigarette at each store using a standardized protocol. So we went back to the IRB and we said that we would like to do this, and we, you know, of course we realized that we didn't want to raise issues for the store, so we said, well, we're not going to identify any individual store or sales clerk or owner from the data. We had procedures in place so that they were all numbered and separated and so forth. We were going to only report our findings in the aggregate. Well, the IRB refused this modification, and they said, first of all, there were some issues with the way they refused it. They thought the community research partners that were going to be our data collectors, they thought we were recruiting them. They didn't realize they were part of the research team in the first place. They kind of didn't get that. And we paid our community research partners. And in addition to that, they raised these issues about violence, and they would be going into these stores, and would they be safe? And of course, these are people that live in this neighborhood. I mean, they go to these stores. So we thought, this is kind of a strange thing that they're raising this. And they said we'd be soliciting them to commit an illegal act, and we couldn't do that. And they were also worried that this would constitute entrapment of the store personnel. So they refused, and so we appealed this, and the IRB did this very unusual referral. They said, why don't you go talk to risk management? Now, risk management for the University of California at San Francisco deals with like insurance contracts and liability issues for the university. They don't deal with research, and they didn't know what to do with us when we showed up. It was like, why did they send you here? They were baffled by this. And they said, well, you should go talk to legal. So we went to talk to legal. And legal didn't really want to deal with us either, but after an interminable time of investigating the issue, they basically said, it's up to the IRB. And they sent us back to the IRB. And the IRB said no. So we appealed yet again. And we actually went to the IRB meeting in person with our community co-investigator, with the district attorney's signed grant of immunity, saying that nobody would ever be prosecuted based on anything we found from this study. We gave them the section of the California Penal Code that says that buying a single cigarette was not illegal, so we took care of this problem about soliciting our partners to buy a cigarette that was illegal. It's not illegal. We had a written attorney from the state opinion from the state attorney general saying that this was not entrapment because this was basically the same procedure they used to conduct surveys about sales to minors. Exactly the same thing. We had a standard protocol that was derived from their procedures for this. We had documentation from other similar studies that had done things like this and been published in major journals and okayed by IRBs and other major research institutions. And we had a letter of support from the State Tobacco Research Program. And we spent probably an hour in discussion with the IRB around the big table. We also argued that it was important for the university to consider the community's knowledge and skills about what was going on in their community, and that was part of the nature of this kind of research. And finally, that the unit of analysis was not the individuals working in the store. The unit of analysis was the store, and that we were studying institutional practices. The IRB's final decision? No. So we were somewhat shocked by this, and it took me about a year and a half to get over my peak enough to even think it through. But after I finally got to that point, I realized that part of the problem was the way the IRB characterized research ethics, and particularly UCSF, which is solely a biomedical campus. they think of it in terms of biomedical ethics. For them, the anticipated benefits didn't justify the procedures, although the nature of the risks that they thought were involved was never really made clear to us, particularly with our protections that we had built in. They said we should do a different kind of study. Why don't you go do a survey? Why don't you do something else? And the community research partners really did not respond well to this. This really affected their view of the university. They experienced this as the university betraying the community and favoring what they called community predators. And the title of the eventual paper that came out of this was, "It's Like Tuskegee in Reverse." And that was what one of our community partners said, which meant to her, you know, now that we want to do our own research, they won't let us. You know, they'll do research on us, but they won't let us do our own. So it was a very strong reaction from the community. The CRPs actually broke off from the FAT project and conducted this independently, which of course they could do, you know, just as normal members of the community. They could go out and explore this on their own. They didn't have to, you know, they didn't have to ask for no stinking IRB approval to do it on their own. But the disadvantage there was that they then could not, you know, this could not be publicized as a result of the FAT project. We could not lend them help to publicize it and that sort of thing. So, you know, it definitely probably got less attention in the community as a result. So back to the biomedical ethics perspective. Here you really focus on individuals as subjects. And of course this derives out of the original Tuskegee study, which there is a certain irony here. For them, store personnel are clearly research subjects who must provide consent. And it's based on, you know, an analysis based on ethical principles like non-maleficence. So we can't do anything that would be harmful to these individuals without their consent. And that deceiving them or asking to buy a cigarette would constitute deceiving them. Asking to buy a cigarette when you didn't really want that cigarette, I guess, is probably how they would say it, would be deceiving them. So, and also this issue of putting community members at risk, which still seems very odd to me. From our perspective, which was from a more critical or communitarian ethical perspective, human beings are not viewed as isolated subjects, but as embedded in a social world, in a social community. You have a social ecological perspective on risks and benefits. And so we wanted to problematize the assumptions of a biomedical view of ethics. From our perspective, there were questions about whether this really constituted human subjects research, what the real risks were, and who was at risk, and finally, whether institutional conflicts of interest influenced the decision-making in this particular case. So did it constitute human subjects research? Well, this is the definition of human subjects research. There are individuals whose physiologic or behavioral characteristics and responses are the objects of study. But we argued that was not the case here. We didn't care about these people as individuals. And it wasn't as though in practice, every day individuals came in and decided, should I sell single cigarettes today? No, the store either had the box there with the single cigarettes in it that they sold as a practice, as an institutional practice in that store, or they did not. So that was our feeling about what we were up to with this study. We didn't care about the people as individuals, not that we didn't care. That was not the focus of our study. What were the risks and who were the risks for? Well, for the biomedical view, the store clerks were at risk because we could expose their illegal behavior. They could have this psychological risk of feeling deceived by us asking to buy a cigarette when we didn't really want to buy one. And they could feel lured into acting illegally. That was the concern. From our perspective, from a more communitarian perspective, the risk would be for the stores as institutions, But given the kinds of protections that we had built in with the grant of immunity from prosecution and all the other things, and the fact that data would only be reported in the aggregate, we felt that the risk for stores was really pretty minimal at that point. Finally, did institutional conflicts of interest affect the decision-making of the IRB? And this is what I finally began to wonder about. Because I started thinking about the hot potato referrals to the risk management department and then the legal department. It was like nobody really wanted to deal with this. Somehow they were worried there would be bad press, I think. I think on some level there was concern that the institution would end up looking bad. And so were they really protecting the subjects or were they protecting the institution? And they also raised all these issues about the dangerousness of this that made me wonder if they would have raised the same issues if we had wanted to do this same study in a well-to-do community. I don't know the answer to that, and of course they would not feel that that was the case. And I think this is just such a great example, though, of how we have these ideas about what constitutes ethics. And they are not necessarily always the same, depending on our point of view. So I'm not saying that IRBs are not important. Obviously, they're critically important for protecting and managing risk in research. But I think if we are going to engage in community-based participatory research, we really have to think about how there are power dynamics that are embedded at all levels, from the decisions about what is going to be studied, to the IRB approval, to the dissemination. And we really need to be conscious of that and explicit about that as much as we can be. So if we're going to encourage this kind of research, then I think IRBs, particularly at biomedical institutions like my own, probably need to expand their view of what ethics really is. And consider when they may be actually unconsciously or consciously protecting institutional power at the expense of community empowerment. So, thank you.
We still have some time, so if you want to ask a question.
Yeah, our paper about this was in American Journal of Public Health. So if you just look for my name, and it's called "It's Like Tuskegee in Reverse."
In the back.
I wanted to ask about the contribution of your IRB, if there is any benefit from the social sciences, human services sciences. We had experience where we didn't really. There were several protocols from one department that involved these kind of issues, and not only until one member from that department joined the human subjects committee, things started to change.
Yeah, we do have social science people on the IRB, and there are also, I think there's at least one community representative on the IRB, but I think it's just a learning curve for some of these institutions that have been for decades mostly focused on individual health, you know, research from the cellular level to the behavioral level, and then here you are out at this other, you're beyond even, you know, you're really out at that institutional level, and it's a learning curve. So, I think it's possible that in a different year, with a different constitution of the IRB, maybe we would have gotten approval. You know, we'll never know.
Has there been any intentional effort to educate the IRB in terms of the communitarian perspective, based on what your lessons learned?
Well, I think our article probably educated them a bit. At least it encouraged a great deal of dialogue and reflection on their part. I still think that the chair of the IRB, who was, I think, somewhat offended by our article, nevertheless, I think there was a lot of discourse and dialogue, and it was featured in some articles
publications that go out to IRBs, you know, as a sort of debate thing. So I think, you know, more has happened. We didn't engage in it, you know, beyond writing the article, but I think it has become a focus for further discussion around this. And you had a follow-up, or?
Well, I think the fact that you were not invited to engage with the committee says a lot about the institution not wanting to move yet. They're not ready. Because I'm thinking that one of the responsibilities of an IRB is to educate themselves. And that's actually in one of the purposes of the federal legislation. So the fact that it just sort of happens or doesn't happen depending on a reaction is curious.
Well, I don't want to make our IRB look like a total villain, because I do think that they did then further engage in some other efforts around this, but I don't know that they've changed their position. Yeah. You have.
Well, I guess mine deals with how do we help our community partners deal with the data they have. You see documentaries all the time on television that go out and do these investigations. If we could link them with the media, so they could share their data in a public way.
Right.
So we've empowered them to make connections in that way. I don't know.
Yeah. Did everybody hear that in the back, her comment about linking the community with media? Yeah. I mean, that's an excellent idea. I mean, of course, after we got turned down, we basically had to back off. We hinted to our community partners at some possibilities that they might do if they were people who went out and did something like this, unrelated to our project, you know, hypothetically only. But, you know, we couldn't really be involved in helping them with that at that point. So I don't want to take more time. I think my time's up, isn't it?
Just up, yes. Thank you. Our next presentation is from Darlene Perkins, who is a doctoral student in nursing, correct? And doctoral candidate, I guess. And a fellow at NIH in bioethics, and is doing her work, practicing, and her investigation is in Alaska. So glad we could provide good weather here.
Yeah, it's wonderful. How do we get? I'm actually going to sit over there.